Wann hast du zuletzt eine Stelle besetzt und gedacht, das war einfach? Wahrscheinlich lange her. Recruiting kann echt kompliziert sein. Es geht aber auch anders. Die Recruiting-Plattform Instafo liefert dir dank AI Matchmaking nur passende Bewerbungen in deine Pipeline und per Chat kannst du direkt mit ihnen kommunizieren. Instafo erreicht über Podcasts, Reddit, YouTube und Co. Talente, die sonst schwer zu finden sind. Funktioniert für Enterprises wie RTL und GLS, aber auch für Scale-Ups wie du, Instruct und Finanzguru. Du zahlst nur bei Erfolg und sparst über instafo.com/podcast 500 Euro bei deiner ersten Einstellung. Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. Trying to keep it together as I move towards this special that I tape a week from today in New York City. I believe we moved most of the tickets. My show's at the Orange Peel in Asheville, North Carolina. Tomorrow night are sold out. There's definitely tickets for Nashville at the James K. Polk Center on Saturday. There's probably some good seats there. My HBO special taping, as I said, at Town Hall, New York City on Thursday, December 8th. I think there might be two tickets left for the second show. I don't know. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for all the dates and ticket info. Before I go on rambling, James Gray is on the show today. He's a writer and director who first got noticed with the movie Little Odessa back in the 90s. He made the films Ad Astra, The Lost City of Z, We Own the Night, among others. His latest movie is Armageddon Time. I talked to Jeremy Strong about it a few weeks ago, and we have a nice talk. I was nervous at first, but we're two frequencies of the same type of Jew. So, I don't know, you guys. I just spent the day. I'm ready. You know, I got to get my house sitters set up. I've got to, I've got to change all my litter boxes. I've got to start projecting that one of my cats is sick. I've got to start worrying about. I've got these fucking carpenter ants. They're not hurting anybody, but I'm tired of seeing them. I'm tired of watching the ant parade along the ceiling of my bathroom. I don't know why they can't be gotten rid of. But it's a bit of a nuisance, a bit of an annoying thing to just sort of realize I'm cohabitating with all kinds of bugs and things. Cats, bugs, fleas. Cats got fleas somehow. Had to deflea them. I imagine the fleas are in the house. Now I got the ants. It's because I leave. It doesn't matter, man. I don't have a floppy door for the cats to go in and out of to their catio. So I kind of leave it kind of open. Got moths in my closet. They've eaten some fairly prime Pendletons. Hope they're happy. I hope that's some quality wool feasting. But look, this is the way it goes. The bugs are going to get us all. That's just the way it goes. Maybe this is just a way of adapting to it. Got fleas, carpenter ants, moths in the closet. There was a swarm of bees the other day on my porch. I don't know what they wanted. I feel like it's all an indicator. I had a tree full of parrots 3 days ago. Just the Glendale parrots, Pasadena parrots, whatever you want to call them. These green parrots that fly around Los Angeles were all just hanging out in my tree. Is it a sign of something? I got a lot of birds going on. There's a lot of bird action, a lot of squirrel action, possum action. I think there's a couple skunks around. I do not know what happened to the rest of Charlie Beans' family. All right, so I mentioned to you that James Gray is here, and it's interesting, the hyper-awareness of Jewishness now as a Jew because of the heightened anti-Semitism. As a Jew, you become hyper-aware of the Jewness of you. And if you're like me, you kind of want to kind of hit the bell a little bit. What else are we supposed to do? Just diminish ourselves, try to pass. Look, I'm sorry on some level, but not really, that for thousands of years, because of being marginalized and sort of pushed around, that the Jews have figured out a way to adapt and succeed in almost every situation, but not just succeed, excel to levels that people have a hard time wrapping their brain around. And it seems that most of the anti-Semitism that I understand or that I see if you break it down, it's just jealousy. Yeah, it's hard to accept that a small minority of people that have always been a minority in the global population have done so many fucking amazing things and made so many fucking amazing contributions to culture, science, art, business. It's daunting, I know, for regular people, for non-Jews, to really take that in. So if you want to believe in big conspiracies, the Jews run the world, not really true. The Jews run show business, not true. Easy tropes. I mean, they work in these areas. They work in world running. Jews work in show business. Hollywood was built by a handful of Jews who then manufactured the American dream and defined it for non-Jews everywhere so they could live in it. Yeah, another adaptation. Most of the fictions that sort of were used to base the American dream on, white picket fences and aw shucksness, was put out there in early films and movies over and over again by the Jews of Hollywood. They were like, here's the world we invented for you. Can we live in it, please? We've made it. Can we live in it? So, yeah, I get it. I understand that most anti-Semitism comes from jealousy. I do not know where the black community gets off on in terms of the type of anti-Semitism they have. There was a time where progressive socialist Jews marched with the voting rights activists during the civil rights movement. Jews died with African Americans during the civil rights movement. They were aligned. They were fighting the same fight for human rights, for workers' rights, for civil rights. And at some point, the paradigm shifted. At some point, people like Farrakhan introduced this Zionist-occupied government business, this old anti-Semitic, the Elders of Zion, all that other shit, and just sort of started to pollute the brains. I'm not saying that slumlords and certain people within the music business did us much good either. But look, man, look, woman, you know, we're just trying to get by like everybody else. What are we supposed to do? Apologize for our amazingness? The Jews, I'm not even talking about myself. I'm just a regular, average, working Jew. I'm not a genius. I didn't create any scientific breakthroughs or make any amazing paintings or produce any profound music. I'm just a guy. I'm just a Jew guy moving through a world that seems frighteningly anti-Jew right now. But again, I understand your resentment. I understand your jealousy. And it is hard to accept just how amazing Jews are. Especially in this time where everyone's looking to blame somebody for something. God forbid you just acknowledge that the fucking game is rigged and all this infighting amongst us is just a distraction. As the world ends and the people who are amassing all the money are amassing it. And I would say most of them at this point, not Jews. So James Gray is an interesting guy, smart guy, a great director. His new movie, Armageddon Time, very Jewy, but good. I don't need to qualify that. It's about his life. It's playing in theaters and available to rent on video on demand platforms. And we had a nice talk. For you people that are uncomfortable with Jewish content or Jews talking or Jews mentioning that they're Jewish, this might be triggering. So there's a trigger warning for anti-Semites.
Wann hast du zuletzt eine Stelle besetzt und gedacht, das war einfach? Wahrscheinlich lange her. Recruiting kann echt kompliziert sein. Es geht aber auch anders. Die Recruiting-Plattform Instafo liefert dir dank AI-Matchmaking nur passende Bewerbungen in deine Pipeline und per Chat kannst du direkt mit ihnen kommunizieren. Instafo erreicht über Podcasts, Reddit, YouTube und Co. Talente, die sonst schwer zu finden sind. Funktioniert für Enterprises wie RTL und GLS, aber auch für Scale-Ups wie du, Instruct und Finanzguru. Du zahlst nur bei Erfolg und sparst über instafo.com/podcast 500 Euro bei deiner ersten Einstellung.
I find what's happening with me and the Stones right now is kind of odd. Like, I've loved them my whole life, but, like, I keep finding more depth to it somehow. And I kind of recontextualize them all the time.
Right.
It's a weird thing. Like, I've gotten deeper into listening to Keith as he gets older. And I saw them, it's funny, because I saw them in Florida in their last American show on this last tour at the Hard Rock, small for them. Like
Without Charlie.
Well, yeah. Yeah, no, I saw them with Charlie many years ago in San Diego. But I just got free tickets. I was down there because I was visiting my mother.
Right.
So I reached out to their publicist. I said, can I go? And I went with my brother. And people were saying, you know, they'd ask me, like, was it great? And I'm like, no. No, it's not great. But it's them.
Right.
They're doing it.
Right.
You know, and even Keith, like, if he can, he, like, launch it. Like, he'll cock. You know, for a chord, and you're happy he hits the chord. It's not a matter of the song anymore. No,
of course.
Yeah.
They were sort of all vibe in a way. What's your favorite period of theirs?
Well, what I listen to the most lately, you know, they just released the Elma Combo live record.
Yeah.
Did you get it?
No, I haven't yet, but I know about it. Yeah. Is it fantastic?
Yeah. Well, it's like that one, the one side, the two sides on Love You Live. It's that concert, those series of shows.
Yeah.
And that was pretty good. I tend to listen to Yaya's a lot.
It's incredible.
It is, man.
It's incredible. And people don't really know that record anymore. I don't know why. In fact, I think that's the best version of Sympathy for the Devil they ever did.
Pretty great.
Yeah.
And Midnight Rambler, too.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, that's Mick. Isn't
yeah,
it?
Mick Taylor
is
yeah.
playing on that. Yeah.
I had a revelation on that record where I was like, oh, my God, this whole endeavor would completely fall apart without Charlie and Bill.
Yeah.
Completely fall, like that record, that rhythm section is so fucking tight.
Yeah, and in fact, yeah, he's sort of the drummer's drummer, right?
I guess so.
Watts. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he's a very strange drummer, that sort of lifting up of his arm.
Yep.
And
yeah.
He also drums with a traditional jazz, yeah. Not a match grip like Ringo
yeah.
used to. Very weird, great group. Yeah, all rhythm, by the way, you're quite right. I can't believe we're talking about the Stones.
It's the best. It's the best. I mean, they're one of the only bands that I listen to fairly regularly, and for some reason I've been listening to Talking Heads again pretty regularly.
My son loves them. It's so weird you would say that. I haven't listened to them in 30 years, I confess. Mm. I used to love them. I'm sorry. I'm talking way too much
what
about
do you
this stuff to you.
Why?
Well,
what
I just
else because, we can talk about movies?
Well, you can talk about anything you want to talk about. But the Stones for me are, I put them solidly, and you may be offended by this, but I put them solidly at number 3.
Behind?
It's impossible for me to put anyone other than the Beatles at number 1.
Yeah, I get it.
The scope and the depth of the work is yeah. insane.
Yeah, it's kind of wild. It's kind of, you know, do you watch that doc?
Of course.
What I mean, what is that?
Well, the Get Back creation, which I'm sure you saw in the first 2 hours.
I talked to Jackson about it.
It's astonishing.
Well, what's astonishing about it is they're just guys, and, you know, they're just kind of like guys you might even know.
Yeah.
But as soon as they all pick up their instruments without talking or knowing anything, they make magic.
It's, like, it's insane.
Almost involuntarily.
You know, my son, who is a bass player, he said to me, he said, you know, he loves Paul's bass playing. And he said to me, he said, Dad, you know, how did they sign their record contract, all this stuff? He wanted me to tell him about the history.
Yeah.
So Decca Records had turned them down. And on YouTube, they're available. So the Decca session. So I said, well, let's listen to it. So we start listening to it, and they're not good.
Yeah.
But I realize it's John, Paul, George, and Pete.
Oh, really?
And the rhythm section is poor.
Is that true?
Oh, yeah.
Huh.
And so you needed Ringo.
Right.
And there's some weird, to your point, there's some kind of alchemic thing that happens with those four people
right.
playing together.
Right.
And it's like you can't even believe it. The Jackson thing with them playing, with Paul just sitting down and going, trying to do Get Back.
Yeah.
Instantly coming up with that song is nuts.
Yeah, well, I saw there's a moment in Above Us Only Sky.
Yeah.
Where I really saw that more you know, before the Get Back thing. There's a moment where, you know, John has George come over to play guitar and something.
Right, on Imagine,
yeah. Yeah.
The album.
Yeah, on the album, right. That's what they're recording. And in the session, you know, there's all these musicians in the room, and George is sitting there, and John's at the piano. And, you know, George is holding his guitar, and John just, like, hits a couple things at the piano, and George looks at him, and there's this moment, and then George just hits a riff, and there's that. You know, nothing
Absolutely.
Is said, and it was like, oh, my God.
Absolutely.
That's the whole thing.
Yeah, and in fact, when apparently John doing his solo records, particularly starting over toward the end,
yeah,
he kept saying to Andy Newmark, who was a very good drummer and drummed with Sly and the Family Stone, he kept saying, no, do it like this, like Ringo. 10 years after they broke up, he's still asking
so
for Ringo.
It's so sad, isn't it?
It's sad. I mean, that is very disturbing. Your life sort of peaks at 23, 24.
It's crazy. I think age was it happened differently then.
Well, certainly, I mean, Orson Welles, right? 26 years old.
I can't even imagine it. I mean, I can't imagine a 26-year-old now doing that.
Well, he had a huge support system, Orson
Welles.
But
even then, I mean, when you look at 20 people, you know, people in their 20s, it's sort of like, or even me in my 20s, I thought I was something, but I don't think I was anything.
Yeah, I actually made my first film at 23, and I was a moron. I did not know anything.
What, Little Odessa?
Yeah, I was very young, and if I knew how little I knew, I would never have hired me.
Really?
Yeah.
But I mean, were you out of film school, or what did you do?
Well, I was out of film school. I'd made a short film, which I'm sure is wretched. Yeah. And for some reason, well, I made
You've
a
never
very,
seen it?
I've made the mistake of watching. In fact, I had a very awful moment where they showed that film along with David Lynch's short film in his time at AFI. And Robert Zemeckis's, and mine was by far the worst, which was sobering. But I made a very smart decision in the midst of awfulness, which was that I used Bo Diddley and Billie Holiday songs in the movie instead of getting, friends on a Casio tone to do the score.
Sure.
So the movie all of a sudden seemed like it was professional.
Oh, good. Yeah.
And so I got an agent, and they hired me to do a movie, and that was all madness.
Thanks to Bo Diddley.
Thanks to Bo Diddley and Billie Holiday.
which Bo Diddley song?
I used Bo Diddley, and also 500% More Man.
Yeah. That's good.
It's spectacular.
Yeah.
Made me seem like a pro.
That's the best beat.
Yeah.
Who turned you on to Bo Diddley?
I have a strange one. You ever see the movie Fritz the Cat, the animated film?
Yeah, maybe a million years ago.
Yeah, Ralph Bakshi uses the entire song in the movie.
Really?
I must have been 11 or 12. I saw it quite by accident.
How did you end up at Fritz the Cat? How old are you? Well, you're a little younger than me. How'd you end up at Fritz the Cat?
You may know about this, but in the early 80s, there was a huge network of revival houses all around New York City, which was fantastic. They had a theater called The Thalia, which was uptown. Yeah. It was a terrible, I mean, it was a dump, but it showed amazing films. And downtown, there was the Bleecker Street Cinema. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The Theater 80, these things.
Yeah.
And there was a double feature of Ralph Bakshi movies, Fritz the Cat and Heavy Traffic.
Oh, and Heavy Traffic.
And I went.
Yeah.
And I was maybe 12. I didn't know what I was going to watch.
But you were coming in from the island?
I was coming from Queens, where I grew up.
So I saw the new movie. I always wondered that about people in Queens and stuff, because there is because I do comedy. I just got, I've been on the road a lot. And, you get a little out on the island, not Queens, but a little further out. And people don't go to the city. I mean, there's a type of person that's going to go. And then there's a type of person that just like, why?
You're completely right. In fact, my uncle, who had the fantastically poetic name of Seymour.
Yeah.
He used to say, you're going to New York, he would say to me. He'd say, you're going to Manhattan? I'd say, yeah. He'd say, I have problems with the city. And I never knew what that meant. I have problems with the city.
Yeah.
And finally, a few years ago, I asked my cousin, I said, well, what did your dad mean by that? He said, I think he meant he had problems with the parking.
Yeah.
But I loved it. I mean, to me, it was like Eden. I would take the train in and the E or the F. And 15 minutes later, I'd be in the center of Manhattan.
And they let us do that. I'm 5 or 6 years older than you, but I'd go, my family's from Jersey. I lived there most of my life. I lived in Albuquerque. I go back there, visit my grandmother in Jersey. And she put us, 14 years old, they put us on the bus and just go to Port Authority and wander around Times Square.
Yeah, it's actual madness because I have 3 children now, 17, 15, and 13, and I would never let them do that. I mean, the 17-year-old, yes, but not the 13-year-old. I was 10 riding the New York subways by myself.
1981?
This would have been 79 I started.
Right. Not a great time.
Horrendous. The thing is, also, people forget what the trains physically looked like.
Right.
It was filthy. The trains were covered with graffiti.
Yeah.
It was like a dungeon,
Right.
And so you would go down in there. It felt dim and dark. There's actually an excellent book by a photographer named Bruce Davidson chronicling that period of the New York subways. It's called Subway.
Yeah.
Who would have thunk it? And it his pictures are great, and it's that time period exactly. And I loved it. It felt dangerous and exciting.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Of course. Well, why wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But the odd thing is that you felt safe enough because there was people all around.
Yes, that's true. I never. The funny thing is, one time I remember this was maybe a couple of years later. I might have been 12, and I took the train home at around 1:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
Packed.
At 12.
Packed.
Yeah. Yeah. And people, like, the weird thing I notice about New York, and I think it's true, and I think that if you've lived in New York, you've spent time in New York, it actually gives you hope in people. Because despite all the, you know, rough types, if some shit goes down in the subway or on a street, people will be there to help quickly.
I completely agree. There's a very funny and very famous cartoon or comic from the New Yorker magazine that has an LA person and a New York person walking their dogs towards each other.
Yeah.
And the thought balloon of the New Yorker is saying, go fuck yourself. And the thought balloon is, have a nice day. And the Californian is saying, have a nice day. And his thought balloon is, go fuck yourself. That's New York for me. I love them. I love New Yorkers.
Do you live there now?
No, I live here. I've lived here permanently, off and on, and I've now lived here permanently since 2012. I came back here after I made a film called The Immigrant, which was a particularly difficult experience in the release of the film, dealing with a certain person named Harvey Weinstein. And my wife and I had just had enough.
Yeah, of New York?
Yeah, because it conjured bad memories, you know, of like meetings with the guy going, I hate your work and I'm going to destroy you and all this crap.
He said that to you?
He said, that and versions of that over and over again.
But what was that based on?
He hated the work. I mean, it's pretty simple. Harvey was a very mercenary person.
Where was he from? Is he like a...
Queens, very close by.
Well, that's what it feels like to me. It's like you represented something.
Yeah, I was kind of like, maybe if I actually ever touched him, we both might burst into flames or something.
Right.
He's still with us, but he was like the untamed id or something, you know? And in a way, if you put him in a movie and you cast him as the heavy, it would be like, no, you can't do that because that's typecasting.
Right.
You look like the Kingpin out of the Spider-Man comics.
Well, what were you dealing with? He didn't do any of your movies? You just met with him?
He did two of my films.
Right.
The first one I got into myself. The second one,
The Yards he did?
He did The Yards. He financed that. And that was a pretty nightmarish experience. And then... Why? Because, you know, he takes the film, he says, well, here's what you got to do. You got to have a happy ending and you have to have this and you have to have that. He was a frustrated director, by the way. He had made a film, believe it or not, called Playing for Keeps.
Yeah.
Not, there was one that came later in like the 2000s, but his is in the mid-80s. You cannot see it. Basically, he got all the copies of it eradicated.
Yeah. We tried to do that with a lot of things.
That's certainly true. I mean, I have filmmakers to this day calling me up in tears saying, how did you get your film out, you know, from him? Because he shelved so many movies.
Huh.
It's crazy. People
but you got The Yards through?
I got The Yards through, and then I went off and made some other pictures. And then when I did The Immigrant, he bought it.
Yeah.
And I didn't know he bought it.
Right.
And I got deeply upset. Because my reaction was, well, that guy is going to put it on a shelf somewhere in Lower Manhattan. And he tried to do it, and I got into huge fights. And he was crazy. He called me up one day. He said, I have been working on your movie since 2 o'clock in the morning. I said, what?
He was mad that some woman left.
Well, he said...
That he scared away.
Exactly.
That he said, raped.
I can't... What are you... Don't make me laugh at this. It was a horrible story.
Yeah.
But He said, my daughter was born today. I said, oh, congratulations. Don't congratulate me. I've been in here working on your movie, getting your movie into better shape. I said, well, I think you should go home and be with your wife. He goes, well, I'm doing this for you. I said, you're not doing this for me. You're doing it so that you can recut my movie. I didn't ask you to. I had final cut. He couldn't do anything about it. It sat on a shelf for a year. Then finally it got released.
That's crazy.
Yeah. But so that's how you dealt with him.
But did you know any of the other shit that was going on?
None. I mean, and in fact, you know, I know that Quentin Tarantino's spoken publicly about it a lot.
Yeah.
He may have had more of a hint of it than I did because he was with Mira Sorvino.
Yeah.
I never had any exposure to that sort of thing.
Now, when on the Yards, you work with James Caan, another New York guy.
That's right.
How great was that?
Well, I got along fantastically well with him.
Why wouldn't you? Except you're just from a different borough.
Yeah, well, no, actually, he was from Queens as well. He was from Sunnyside, Queens.
His father was a butcher,
that's right.
Yeah, I mean, I talked to him, and it's like, you know, he's a real, you know, he's a piece of work, man. He's relentless.
Jimmy was, he had a kind of obsession with his own machismo in a way. And
no kidding.
Yeah, and he was the one who really gravitated towards, you know, how should we put this, the less savory characters that were around on The Godfather, and he befriended a lot of them. I absolutely adored him, and I thought he was an underrated actor.
Was he underrated? He,
absolutely.
I think, like, you know, when I talked to him, I went into it. I did a deep dive on him, you know. And I interviewed his son years ago, Scott.
A fantastic guy, by the way.
Yeah, great guy. But, like, you know, it wasn't just gangsters he liked. He was hanging out with the Mossad.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah, he had a thing. I'm telling you, he was like...
But wasn't he that thing? He seemed to me that, like, you know, he... See, I have this theory about, you know, you have peasant Jews... You know, who were built to lift things and move things, and then you have, like, you know, mathematic Jews, you know, like symphony Jews,
right?
And,
like Oppenheimer. Or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got these two camps, and I always thought that he was like one of the alpha Jews.
He was definitely, there's a book on it. It's called Tough Jews.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen that.
He was a tough Jew.
Yeah.
And he liked
what's that guy's name? Alsander? What's the guy who wrote that?
Oh, I don't remember.
You read it, though?
No, I have not read it.
It's a good cover. Yeah. A couple of guys in a paddy wagon, right?
Well, I didn't read it because it's like, in some ways, sort of partly my life story. My family was sort of split between the tough Jews and the Edward Teller Jews, the math Jews.
Yeah.
We had both sides. My father was the tough Jew side.
Was he?
Oh, absolutely.
Because, like, in the movie, he's, you know, Jeremy plays him. He's definitely emotionally erratic.
I would say that that is incredibly accurate to who my father was, what Jeremy Strong is doing. But my father's father was a tough, tough plumber who came over from Russia, actually Ukraine, 1923, and he was not going to take any shit.
Right.
I mean, he was a brutal and bruising guy. Didn't speak any English.
Yeah.
Would sit on the couch. Would come over. He would sit on the couch and cry.
Yeah. About what?
I'd say, well, why are you crying, Grandpa?
Yeah.
Your grandfather is saying he's crying because he misses the old country.
Yeah.
So what the hell are you missing? They wanted to chop your head off.
Yeah, right. Weird, right?
Yeah, he was also famously very physically strong. He'd, like, carry bathtubs by himself up four flights of a walk-up.
That's why my grandfather had a hardware store and then an appliance store.
Yeah. My grandfather had a plumbing place in Bed-Stuy.
Yeah. Yeah, but Ukraine, too. I'm part Ukraine.
Where? Do you know where?
Galicia.
Oh, Galicia. Yeah, that's my family as well.
No shit.
Yeah.
I got Galicia on one side, and I got Belarus and Pela settlement on the other side.
This sounds extremely familiar, I will tell you.
Of course, we're all, And then there's some weird, you know, there was my father's maternal grandfather, or great-grandfather was down in the Carolinas when they all landed in Jersey on the shore. But then after the Civil War, you know, they wanted white men to come down there to start businesses. So the entire state wouldn't become a black state. I think, wow. I don't know if it was North, it was, I think it was South Carolina. So he was down there opening grocery stores, and he was, I think, bipolar, which is what explained my father. Was your father bipolar? Because of finding your roots.
But the bipolar part they know?
Well, no, but he was erratic. There was newspaper articles. He fought with his son about property. He ended up, going to court. So, and my dad's got the thing, the manic thing.
Well, my father was never diagnosed with anything like that, although he was certainly a strange guy. I mean, he had, you know, love and violence in equal measure.
But you were able to identify that as love?
You know, as a kid, if it's your only reality, of course, right? I mean, you don't have another alternate, like Mike Brady dad to compare it to.
Well, it's interesting, though, you know, like I get that. I get that. I mean, you have to believe that they love you.
Of course.
But then when you grow up, you're like, why am I a twisted emotional freak?
Right. Well, isn't that everybody? I mean,
I don't know. You know, like, I read this book that it's called The Fantasy Bond by this guy Firestone. It's a psychologist. And it kind of blew my mind. It was one of these puzzle pieces where he said, when you're a kid, despite whatever your parents are, however crazy or however abusive or whatever is going on, it doesn't matter. The spectrum of it is that, you know, if you feel awkward, uncomfortable, or strange, you know, it's not them.
Like, no matter how they are to you, they're your parents and they're gods.
Right.
So if you feel fucked up, you're going to blame yourself, install a parent in your head that says you stink, and listen to that guy for the rest of your life.
Wow, that is so, that's completely true.
I know.
Oh my God, I you just like unlocked more stuff. I've been, you know, seeing a shrink for 30 years. That's better. That's better than anything I ever heard.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I mean, I should have paid for you. But you know, I always feel like with my parents, that was, you know, sort of my normal.
Right.
But now when I look back at it, you know, what's the old joke that you just want to raise children that are good enough to pay for their own analysis? I just felt that that was normal. And now I look back on it and I'm kind of horrified.
Well, I mean, you look back on it, you made a movie of it.
I had to.
I mean, it's interesting because I said to my producer, I was like, I think he made his first movie last.
Well, that I can't speak to. I will tell you that if I had made the movie 25 years ago,
right,
it would have been a very different picture. You know, you really, I think people change a lot more than they think they do. I think change is underrated. I think I'm very different than I was when I was 23 or 24.
Yeah.
Aren't you?
Yeah, of course. I think that, you know, you're going with what you know until you realize, like, you know, maybe you've been misled.
Yeah, and I also, I have been, over the past 3 or 4 years, particularly thunderstruck by just how little I actually know. And
In general.
And it's very depressing. I've tried to read everything I can. I've never, of course, read Tough Jews, as we just established.
Well, but yeah, I'm the same way. I got a room full of books.
Yeah, I have tons of books.
I like looking at them.
I like looking at them, too. But at some point, you actually have to read them. I mean, I don't know a goddamn thing.
You can get the gist.
The gist? No, I can't.
No, you have to read the whole book, especially if it's dense. You know what I mean?
Well, but I tried cheating my way through Moby Dick many years ago.
That's a novel, yeah. But I mean, like, you know, the stuff that, you know, I can't understand philosophy at all. It's like reading math to me. I can't fucking. And sometimes I feel like, well, when I get older, I'll understand it. I don't understand.
But when you say philosophy, what do you mean? Like
I can't read Kant. Oh, I can't read Spinoza.
No,
I
mean, that's difficult.
I want to know Spinoza. I talked to Jeremy about Spinoza because he played Spinoza in a play. And
Did he know what he was talking about?
A little bit, but you know, you get the gist. Unless you're going to go back to school, and I tried that once, it didn't work.
I see. I've had dreams. I'm never going to do it. You know, it's this chicken shit thing where I say I'm going to. I had dreams of going back to school because I did go to college, but I didn't cheat my way through. But I didn't do.
Where'd you go?
Really, I went to USC. Which was great because
undergrad?
I got scholarship. Yes, I got scholarship money for there, and I really wanted to go to NYU or UCLA.
You didn't. Wait, what was your major?
Oh, I'm undergrad. A complete nerd. I'm a cinema major, but my major was actually a double major because I went there as a production major. I got a scholarship. Like I said, my dream was NYU or UCLA.
Right.
Francis Coppola went to UCLA. Martin Scorsese went to NYU.
Those are your guys.
Those were my guys. Still are in a way. And didn't, you know, I got into NYU, UCLA, I didn't. And I thought, well, do I want to stay in New York? And then I got all this, you know, free scholarship stuff to go to USC, went there, got there, and all of production was technical stuff. It's almost like a trade school.
Yeah.
So they'd say to you, here's how you load a Bolex camera, 16 millimeter, basically stuff now that is worthless.
Yeah.
And then there was this other thing called critical studies. And that I thought was great. That was seeing movies, analyzing them. So I became a double major, and critical studies thing became much more interesting.
You got in your mind you're going to be a filmmaker, and you got Scorsese and Coppola on the brain?
Which was the only... I was very weird for the rest of my classmates. Well, I was also a jerk, which is probably abundantly clear to you.
What kind of jerk?
I was pompous and pretentious. And, you know, I was the only New Yorker in the class.
Yeah.
And I did... I will say I had seen a lot more movies than anybody else in my class.
So as a kid, you're going to the city, you're doing, like, I mean, when do you realize you're a film guy?
I can tell you exactly what it was. I saw a double feature at the Carnegie Hall Cinema, which was this really strange art house where you would take an escalator down and they would serve literally cappuccino in the lobby.
Uh-huh.
And I saw a double feature of Apocalypse Now and Doctor Strangelove.
Yeah.
And I before that, I had seen, you know, Star Wars, the King Kong remake, Superman.
Stuff these that was mainstream when you
mainstream,
were when
yeah.
you were a kid. You like those?
Well, I like Jaws a lot. I still love it.
That Jaws is crazy.
Why do you say that?
It's like it always delivers, no matter how many times you've seen it.
It's a masterpiece. Well, you know, that was Fidel Castro's favorite movie.
Sure.
Because he said the mayor, he'll leave the beach open, doesn't matter how many people get eaten. You
that
know,
was a role model for him?
Yeah, well, I think he saw it as the evil of capitalism and, you know, put in a movie.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so he loved it for that. Still love Jaws, but that was a big one for me.
You read the cultural criticism of Fidel Castro's film work. He did
I'm trying to remember how I knew this about Fidel Castro and Jaws. I can't remember.
Well, Jaws was a big thing for you because it was so effective and so terrifying.
It was brilliantly effective. And
you're by the beach. How long did it take for you to go back in the water?
I'm sorry, I still don't do that.
Did you?
My children have freaked out. I showed them, you know, during lockdown, I showed them Jaws. They freaked out.
Yeah. No, you can't go. We were visiting, I can't remember where the fuck, we were down the shore. I have family in Monmouth County, and I couldn't go in the water. And I remember, like, having seen it.
I understand. But, you know, it's based on a sort of a real series of events. I want to say 1916, I think, in off New Jersey, Atlantic City. Mm. There was a prowling shark that kept eating people. And Benchley had come across that story and put it into that, fashioned it into a kind of a, what he saw as a sort of poor man's Moby Dick. But it's all Spielberg. I mean, he basically channeled it into something ferocious. And it's still an incredibly effective movie. But then I saw, I never forget, I saw Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
And, you know, the black screen and, you know, and I remember thinking, well, what is that? And my world changed.
You did some stuff in City of Z.
Yeah.
These decisions, you know, with the liquor going into the train.
Oh, that's right. Well, I ripped that off from David Lean.
Oh, okay.
Where in Peter O'Toole blows out the match and then he cuts to the, you know, the sunrise in the desert.
Yeah.
And I had wanted some of these transitions to echo David Lean's...
Because that was the scope of the movie.
I was trying to go for that. I mean, who knows? You know, you aim for the stars. What's this? You aim for the stars, and sometimes you might hit Dresden, they say.
But I noticed that there was another one, too. There was the booze one.
Yeah, and there was also the spear on his wall, which cuts to the bayonet in World War I.
Oh, yeah.
I did it a couple of times. You see, that's the magic of genius, you see.
But you see, but you do the reading? Wait, how the hell did you decide on that book?
Well, I'm trying to remember now. I was sent the book in very early stages. It had not been published yet. And one of the things I found was very powerful about it was the idea that this guy had had a father who was a drunk and a gambler.
Yeah.
Had blown not one but two family fortunes. I'm not sure quite how to do that. And wound up, he was like equerry to Edward VII. Anyway, and he had to make up for his disgraced family name. And I found that very powerful. And I had wanted to try something outside of what you might call the comfort zone.
Yeah.
And I really did.
Right.
I
mean, well, at that point, making small movies.
I had made small movies and then wound up founding myself in Amazonia, which was, you know, this like wimpy Jewish guy in the middle of Amazonia. It didn't work out for me physically. I looked like Moses with a beekeeper's outfit. It was really rough. I remember one point I looked down and I had multiple scorpions all over my legs. That's what I said, what am I doing here? You know, what is this? And I remember the cinematographer was one of the great people ever, this guy Dias Kanji, this delightful and urbane Frenchman, and was standing in the middle of this tributary of the Amazon, the Don Diego River.
Yeah.
And he's got this thing on his eye and he's looking at the sky. And I said, Darius, don't you think we should shoot? And we're all knee deep in the river.
Yeah.
And he says, no, the cloud is coming, the cloud. And I said, Darius, I think I see a caiman and I think it's in the water. No, but here you got, don't worry about it yet. I said, no, Darius, there's a caiman and it's coming towards me. Can we please shoot? I mean, it was this kind of shoot.
Yeah.
So it took me a while to recover physically from it. It almost killed me, the picture.
You think so?
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, I came back.
But didn't you know that going in?
No.
You were just sort of like, we're going to the Amazon?
Well, here's what happened. I had looked at, of course, Apocalypse Now and Werner Herzog and these pictures, and I thought, pretty stupidly, I thought, the way this works is, if you plan it completely, and you don't go to shoot during monsoon season, and you're not insane enough to think you can do X, Y, and Z, you know, if you just keep your ambitions... No.
Yeah.
Because you're not supposed to be there.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to bring 100 people into the middle of nowhere to, to, you know, with like snakes and bats shitting on you and monkeys throwing their fecal matter at you. I mean, it's insanity.
Yeah. Well, you needed that. You needed your Herzog Coppola.
I guess I did.
Rite of passage.
Well, at one point, I remember we were shooting. Charlie Hunnam, who was very prompt every day, didn't show up to the set one day. And we were on the river and waiting for the sun to rise. And I hear this little Zodiac comes towards us. And it's his assistant. Charlie cannot come to set. He is in a helicopter. They're taking him to Barranquilla, which was the closest major city. He has a bug, and it has crawled in his ear canal, and it is now eating his eardrum, so he has to get it removed. What the fuck am I doing here?
How'd you feel about the movie?
Well, I was proud that I had done it, if that's a nauseating word. I remember feeling some measure of accomplishment about it, and I like the film. I mean, when you ask me, it's like, I have no distance. It's like, I don't know if the movie's any good, but I like having done it.
But you made interesting decisions. Like at some point, you know, in dealing with that kid, his kid, that, you know, he kind of, you know, what struck me about that film was that, you know, that kid decides at some point to respect his father.
Yeah, that's absolute. That's from the book. And it's an act of such complete madness. But it's all in the context, although it's worth sort of thinking about this, World War One and what World War One did to the world.
Right.
Which was it devastated Europe so badly that all of these young people felt, well, if we don't do crazy things, we might just die in a war anyway.
Right.
Know, because as you know, I'm sure, before World War One, they said, oh, it's going to be 2 weeks.
Yeah.
We're going to go and we'll fight for the country for 2 weeks and then it's fine. We'll go.
Yeah.
And then it turned into this like trench thing for 4 years.
Oh, so it was when he was in the hospital that it changed.
Yeah, all of that changed for the family. I think that the it was a kind of existential crisis all through Europe around 1918. You know.
Yeah, I thought you handled that. You know that. You know that this reunification of these two, you know, out there in the jungle. And then, you know, the turn at the end, but, you know, that, you know, we're going to deliver them to the spirits, and they're, you know, which is like, sounds nice.
Oh, it sounds lovely. Yeah. But that probably means they ate them. Is some evidence that they were eaten. I mean, because the there were these two guys, father and son team, weirdly echoing Fawcett, that went down to try and find Fawcett's, you know, history. This was in the late 1990s.
Right.
And left São Paulo and went off to the middle of the jungle. And were caught by indigenous peoples, and they almost had that happen to them until a Brazilian seaplane came and saved them at the last second.
But I like that they drugged them up first.
That was apparently part of the ceremony. It was almost a kind of ayahuasca. I don't know what they're doing.
It was sort of an act of kindness.
Yeah, I suppose so.
You make the transition easier.
Yeah, that's right. You don't just take out the knife and fork, immediately cut up the, you know, the calf muscle.
Well, I mean, so when you're a kid and you're having this, you know, realization that, you know, helicopters over a black screen has an effect, so that was basically the moment where you realize, like, oh, there's a lot you can do with this.
I just thought it was the greatest art form because it was a combination. You had photography, dance, and how you moved actors. Of course, you have music.
Story.
Of course, narrative. It's like theater is involved.
Did you grow up with the, like, I saw some representation of your home, but I mean, was there support of, well, I guess your grandfather was supportive.
Well, he was, and my grandmother was quite pretentious, you know, and she would say, I'm looking at the Bernini statues, you know, this kind of thing. But not really. I mean, my parents were terrified at the prospect that I might try to become a filmmaker or any kind of creative person. I remember my father was say, you have to have a backup.
Sure, of course.
And you're going to learn. By the way, the funny thing is, what he advocated was ridiculously correct. He said, from a financial point of view, he said, you should go off and you should work. There's a company, and it's in Seattle, and it's called Microsoft. And if you go to work for them, and you're a computer programmer, and, you know, and I, of course, was like, what are you talking about? And I'd probably be worth like $8 billion today.
Well, that's interesting. My grandfather says you get a job at the post office.
The post office.
Because you had a pension.
I see. Well, my father's barometer for me was health insurance. So I understand completely. The post office. Oh, that's grim. I mean, dignity to all work, of course.
But it's interesting about like the sort of disposition of the grandmother and the that first generation of Jewish middle class.
They
right?
were they were strivers for sure, yeah. And they had there was a certain quality of pretentiousness
yeah.
about them.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They were sort of like socialists, but you know, the second that you right. got some money, that was the end of that.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Yeah,
yeah, and then they they immediately. I don't even know if they were trying to pass. They were building their version. Of That's a right. of a middle class.
I don't think there was some attempt to mingle. I remember my parents saying to my grandparents, where there was a lengthy conversation about, there's a very nice pool club, and it's in Great Neck.
Right.
Yeah. And we may go out there and join the pool club if
right.
we can.
Right. Yeah.
And there's also tennis, but we don't play tennis. We're going to go swimming. And we joined it.
Yeah.
And for like
no,
a month.
Was it not a Jewish club?
Let's just say this.
Yeah.
We like hid in the corner under the trees, you know. We were like a different species entirely.
Yeah. Why'd you call this movie Armageddon Time?
Well, I was a huge fan and still am of The Clash.
Yeah.
And I had remembered this song, Armageddon Time, which actually they didn't even write. It was a reggae song originally. And I remember Joe Strummer was saying, a lot of people don't get no supper tonight. A lot of people don't get no justice tonight. They were very involved in social justice. They were my introduction to the idea of social justice, actually. And in a very unpretentious, kind of brutal, dangerous way, The Clash. And I remember Ronald Reagan, because they're talking about Armageddon all the time.
Yeah.
You know, because of the threat from the Soviet Union, this very kind of binary battle.
Yeah.
Good versus evil, you know, the evil empire.
Yeah.
And that threat, you remember, the threat that hung over our heads that the world could end at any second.
Right.
So I felt that it was Armageddon, he would propose Armageddon for the world, but it was also Armageddon time for these two boys, you know, and what would happen to them and how their lives would go in very different directions. I mean, it's all pretentious nonsense maybe, but that's what I was trying to do.
Well, it's interesting that what you were able to encapsulate just through a family story, you know, was kind of, you know, you were able to get, you know, the senior Trump in there.
Well, that's 100% true.
Yeah.
One of the weirdest encounters of all time. I regarded him as a kind of evil clown figure.
He came to your school.
He was on the board of trustees.
Is that, what was his name? Wasn't Donald.
Fred
Trump. Yeah.
And he would parade the halls and he would look very serious and stern. And I was my first day. I was carrying an attaché case, which, of course, is ridiculous.
Who told you that? Your grandfather?
My father.
Your father did. Right.
That's an A1 attaché case. You need that for school. You come to work. I'm a serious student, and I have this for my books. You know, that was his attitude. So I was walking around with an attaché case.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous. And my hair was like cemented down, you know, with dippity-doo hair gel. Hey, what are you doing?
Yeah.
What's your name?
Yeah.
James Gray. James Gray. That's your parents' name or your name or what's the name? You know, like this. And he was sending the message. And I immediately knew what was interesting to me, even at age, I was actually 11.
Yeah.
It was very clear to me that I had thought of myself as the king of the hill in public school. Immediately knew I was at the bottom in this new place. And that was a very powerful thing of the sense of humiliation.
Yeah.
And if I feel that humiliation, I can't imagine what it means for others who are less lucky than I was.
Your friend in the film.
Yeah, I mean,
the African American kid. What's his name?
Devastating. Well, in the movie, it's Johnny. I'm not going to tell you in real life.
Yeah.
But he in the movie, it was devastating for him in a different way.
Yeah.
The system didn't care about him one bit, and that was the whole idea of the picture.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's at a lot of levels.
That's right. That you can this idea. You know, it's very easy for us today. To point fingers. I don't know. Something's happened in the culture. I mean, there are many more erudite people on this subject than I am, but something around 2013, 2014, something like that, where people started to really, maybe it's a social media thing, but like to moralize. And my attitude is everybody plays a role in the system.
Yeah.
And you can be the oppressor and the oppressed at the same time. Some people are above you, some people are below you, you know, and part of you likes that to have people below you.
Of course. And then, but there's a jockeying,
absolutely,
for the most oppressed, and who has the right to talk.
That's right.
So I imagine even coming into depicting your personal experience around this racism, that you know you had to be curious about how it would be received.
I knew that there would be some, and by the way, I've become very good at avoiding reading anything because it's not productive. And usually you need to wait about 10 years before you get an honest assessment of what the work even means.
Uh-huh.
But I did know that the second that you include issues like anti-Semitism, racism, mm-hmm. so forth, and particularly class in the United States, that it's going to, some people are going to like it, some people are going to think it's the worst thing they've ever seen. You just know it.
Yeah, I guess if they're talking about it, it's good.
That's right. Well, it's the third rail of American life, racism. You know, it's right. Like, it's like there's something about it. The reaction to the film, and I knew this would happen in Europe,
yeah.
Is completely different. Because you go and you talk to journalists,
sure. Oh,
you
yeah,
can
yeah.
tell.
Yeah.
You know, I just came back from a trip to Europe.
Well, how is it different?
They don't see the same level of, how do I put this? This like a whole vision of what we call identity politics is completely different. They see class much more than
we don't talk about class.
No,
and,
we don't.
And also the, you know, it's the experience of blacks is different historically in Europe.
Completely different.
Yeah. So it's a discussion of colonialism.
That's right. Right. That's right. But I am one of those people that thinks that class is a major aspect to our identity, and that you can't really isolate. It's not possible to say this is an issue of racism divided away from capitalism itself.
Right.
They're sort of connected, obviously. And my attitude is, you know, that the same striving that drove my parents, you know, who were clearly driven to get to that place in American life, which was better, you know. They used to talk about, our boat will come in. Our boat, they used to say that all the time. I think that's the same thing in some way that was connected to having their foot metaphorically on Johnny's neck, that they're not separate. And I find that in the United States, there's a lot of discussion about how we can get people to be richer and not enough understanding of the systems that are in play that keep things the way they are on purpose.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's there. Yeah, I mean, there's actual sort of fascistic elements that are trying to erase the history of systemic racism.
Yeah, I've been deeply disturbed, but I feel like an old curmudgeon. You know, I'm very much maybe I shouldn't say this, but I'm very much a kind of lefty.
Yeah.
But in the tradition
sure.
of like late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's I think the world has moved to a very strange place now. I never thought, ever, including my relationship or connection to the Trumps, I never thought in a million years that I would be having a discussion with anybody about the possibility of fascism in the United States.
Right.
And here we are.
Oh, for sure.
It's insane.
Yeah, well, there's that. But it also, it seems like in this movie, before we move away from what we were talking about before, fascism and capitalism, and also, like, you know, what's enabling this stuff cinematically, which I think you probably have some concept of. But, I mean, it seemed like you were exercising with an O, your own demons around your guilt in terms of the experience that you were put through.
That's an interesting and excellent question. I don't know how much guilt I have. I was very young.
You remembered it.
Well, that's certainly true. I would say it haunts me, but I don't... what else could I have done? I mean, I was...
Oh, I get what you're saying.
You know,
haunting's,
I mean,
different than feeling shame.
I'm too close to really... I'm too close to it. Obviously, it's my own situation, so I don't blame myself.
Right.
I view it as like a kind of depiction of a world which is completely hostile to children and their, what we call, agency. You know, you can have, because here's the thing, you can have all the agency in the world. And it's, in some way, the kids have agency in the picture. They decide they're going to go off to Florida to Epcot Center, which I know sounds ridiculous as 11 and 12-year-olds it is. But that is a form of agency.
Yeah.
Take action, run away from home. But the system overwhelms that agency, which is different from having no agency. Do you understand what I mean? So in the picture, I was trying to say that there is a measure of action that we try to take, but the system is very powerful and too powerful for us to act sometimes.
Yeah, I didn't grow up with that. I don't know why. I think my parents were a little more hands-off and I was sort of on my own.
But that's not a bad thing.
No, because I was like, I was driven towards creative things, and I wanted to, you know, I was aspiring toward. But I had no
There was no real sort of, I felt my sense of self was nebulous.
I bet you have a lot of grit, though.
I don't know. Well, yeah, I mean, I've gone through some shit.
Right.
You build grit later. You know what
later?
I mean?
Later? No.
Kinda.
You have it in your DNA.
Do you?
I think so. Well, maybe from your parents letting you go off on your own.
I don't know. Maybe I don't know what grit is. I mean, I find that, you know, mostly, you know, I've led a terrified, anxious life where, you know, pretending was essential. And at some point, something relaxes.
Right. When did that happen for you?
It comes and goes, you know, because my brain will always find something to create dread and anxiety. But as a creative person or as somebody who knows they can do a thing, I mean, it was probably about, you know, 10, 15 years ago. I don't know.
Wow, that's
around comedy.
Wisdom.
In my 40s.
That's wisdom.
Yeah, I guess. But like, you know, what good is it? I got no kids. I'm on stage talking to the people, like-minded people who just want to feel better for an hour.
Yeah, but yeah. That's not bad.
No.
Where
does your movies land? How do you find it affects people in general? But before I say that, I would feel remiss. Like in the Lost City of Z,
yeah,
there was a racial component as well.
Of course.
And that must have been something compelling to you given this probably same memory.
I had never thought about that. You're right. It's in there. It's in a couple of other films I've made. I just see it as a major thread in not just American life, but
right.
Western civilization.
But also your immediate life.
I mean, now that you're saying it, yeah, you're right. I never thought about that. It's so weird. But you're right. It's a major thread.
What I'm saying to you is that...
It haunts the hell out of me.
It's a wound.
Yeah. Well, you're probably right. I got plenty of wounds. I have no shortage of wounds.
Emotional wounds.
Physical.
How you
wounds
doing?
Too.
Do you?
Yeah. I'm a mess.
But Ad Astra, that was a good movie. I enjoyed that movie.
I'm glad you liked that.
But you go from this sort of David Lean thing to Kubrick. What was that?
That was Brad Pitt on wires for 58 days. And
you just wanted to string the movie star up?
Yeah, I just wanted to give him some anguish. Right. You know, living in a harness for 3 months.
Dangle Brad Pitt?
I had thought that was... sort of what I was trying to answer all these things where it's like, well, what's out there? What if we set up a life on Mars? Well, you know, I mean, by the way, Elon Musk still talks about it. He said, want to die on Mars.
Right.
And I thought, well,
he should go now.
Yeah, I was going to say, it'd be great. It was an invitation to Mars. Stay there forever. Yeah. But I thought, you know, what's wrong with the Earth?
Yeah.
It's interesting. William Shatner, believe it or not, just came back. He went through Jeff Bezos' thing.
Poor guy. He got all upset.
Yeah, but he said exactly what I was trying to do with the movie, which is that, you know, the Earth is fantastic, and he felt a terrible sense of depression looking at the Earth from far away.
Yeah.
So that's what I was trying to do with that movie. I guess I was trying to embrace the world in a way. Do the anti-Kubrick.
And also, you know, like, you know, try to, you know, connect with Dad.
Well, of course, that's in there. But that was all of that was my attempt to do a kind of Joseph Campbell, like atonement with the father, hero, mythic hero thing.
Oh, that's interesting. So the intention
started out very pretentiously mythic, this idea.
Right.
But the Kubrick
follow the Campbell instructions.
Well, I didn't quite do that.
The hero's journey.
Right, the hero's journey, point A, point B. Yeah. But the Kubrick thing, which, and also the Spielberg thing, which is... kind of a belief in aliens. In Kubrick, it's, of course, a black monolith, so you can kind of project anything on that,
oddly,
right?
Same with Rothko towards the end.
Exactly.
If you go to the Rothko Chapel, it could have been a Rothko
There's no doubt that Kubrick looked a ton at modern works of art for the inspiration about that black monolith, and he was public about it. And in fact...
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And it's
sense.
An amazing,
yeah.
It's like a work of modernist sculpture or something, right?
Sure.
That black monolith. But you can say, okay, aliens are good, aliens are bad. You don't know what it means. Black monolith. We don't know what it is.
Right.
And then Spielberg has this sort of classic cliched, his films are not cliched, but I'm saying the cliched idea of like the furry alien, as they call it. But he gets around it because the films work as fables. They're sort of like, almost like metaphors, like E.T. is like, it's like a metaphor about childhood.
Well, sure. Like, I mean, I think even with the... Kasdan, I think, was pretty much doing the Campbell trip to build that universe.
Luke, I am your father is one of the most genius narrative ideas ever. And when I showed my kids that movie the first time they saw it, the look on their face to see the ogre of all time, Darth Vader, tell him, I am your dad, it was like someone had just like literally devastated their whole worldview forever.
Huh.
Amazingly powerful. So that it might have been Kazan. I think it was also Lee Brackett who wrote it with him. I don't know.
But yeah, because Spielberg does, you know, he does his, a different thing. It's some more, it's the alien thing. Yeah.
But he did find, you know, Spielberg found beauty in it as a kind of metaphor. But my attempt was to do the opposite of the Kubrick and Spielberg thing, which was to say, there are, what if there are no aliens?
Yeah.
This belief in false gods, you know, what does it mean if there's nothing out there?
Yeah.
What kind of crisis is that for us?
What if dad doesn't find what he's looking for?
That's right. He goes out there and there's nothing. That's nice and optimistic, isn't it? I actually think it is optimistic. It means people matter more.
It happened in City of Z, too.
That's true. He goes out there and finds nothing. Great.
He drags his son into the pit with him.
That's great. I'm glad I'm focusing on the lack of transcendence in life. It's a good thing. Jesus.
No, I'm with you. I mean,
yeah, because what's the alternative? You believe in pixie dust in a way. I by the way, those movies are the Coppola. I mean, the Kubrick and Spielberg pictures, the science fiction, are brilliant. But you can't just keep doing it. You know, you have to find another language in the science fiction genre. That's what I was really going for.
No, I liked it.
Well, I'm glad you did.
I mean, you thought it through.
I definitely did that. I had ridiculous dinners with all these astronauts and stuff. I get like great details from
them.
I wish I'd used some of them. I tried to fit in as many as I could, but like I remember I would obsess over the Sharpies, you know.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
What pen would you use?
Oh, really?
Well, it would definitely be the Sharpie because that you can write with that in space. It doesn't matter about gravity. But I remember one astronaut said to me, he said, "The interesting thing is that when you come out of the craft, for about a 2-week period, you do smell astonishingly like hamburger meat."
Hmm.
I was like, I'm sorry, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Nobody really knows the reason you smell like hamburger. I'm like, okay. So I tried to put that in the movie, and I couldn't. Of course, no place to talk about that.
Sure. But
there were weird details.
You don't want to put one joke in the movie. You don't want to ruin your movie with one hamburger joke.
There were jokes I attempted. No. I mean, by the way, nobody laughed. I was like, good to the space shuttle thing, where she says, "Would you like a pillow and blanket?" Which of course is meaningless and no gravity, and nobody laughs.
Nothing,
I mean,
huh? It was the tone. You're up against the tone.
It didn't work out for me, you know, in the heavy space, you know, the void.
Yeah,
you know, it doesn't lend a lot of opportunities for hilarity.
Yeah. You like Spielberg?
Oh, I think he's brilliant.
Did you see The Fablemans?
I have not.
Me neither. When was the last time you saw Munich?
I saw it when it came out.
Holy shit.
You know, that film, I remember watching it thinking it felt almost like he was conjuring some kind of 1970s William Friedkin movie for
a time. He definitely was.
Yeah, and he
probably made it safer than Friedkin. I talked to Friedkin. He's like,
you did?
Yeah, he's like, we just drove the cars. We didn't have any security. He's like, fuck it.
I know. He's a
madman.
He told me that. He said, for The French Connection.
Oh, you talked to him?
Yeah, I love Billy Friedkin. He's amazing. And he said he put the camera on the front of the camera, the front of the car on the bumper.
Yeah.
And the stuntman was a guy named Bill Hickman.
Yeah.
Just drove 90 miles an hour through Stillwell Avenue.
Yeah.
And I thought, what?
Yeah.
You can't. That's calamitous.
Yeah.
We did this drive, and he drove, and it was the scariest fucking thing. And I just was like, wow, okay, well, guess what? I'm glad you're not in prison.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure he is, too.
The greatest collection, by the way, talk about clusters of talent.
Yeah.
You had Robert Duvall and Gene Hackman and Dustin Hoffman and Al Pacino and Robert De Niro. They all knew each other. They all would room. I mean, like, Dustin Hoffman and Gene Hackman were roommates.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
Yep. Yeah. Duvall.
I mean, the Duvall is incredible. I worked with Duvall as well, and he
on what?
On a movie called We Own the Night.
Oh yeah.
And he would. I would say to him, I'd say, "All right, we're going to do another take," and he'd go like this: "Jimmy, take no prisoners." I think, what does that mean? All right, let's do another one.
Yeah.
But he was great. I remember I would do like two or three takes, and I'd love them. And then I'd say, "Do you want to play?"
Yeah.
So, let's play. Let's play. We're going to play. Let's play. And he would go kind of berserk.
Yeah.
He was fantastic.
Did he play?
Oh, of course. He would go. He was a great listener. You know, the actor threw something at him, and Joaquin Phoenix would throw all kinds of weird stuff at him.
Yeah.
And he would always play off Joaquin in the most brilliant fashion.
You like Joaquin. You used him a few.
Four times.
Yeah, and Wahlberg, too.
I love him. Not twice. I love those guys. And, you know, Joaquin is incredibly inventive. You're shooting a film with him, it feels like live theater or something.
Yeah, I watched him work a lot because I had one scene in The Joker.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, and but I was on set for a week watching him toil in that role.
And what was your impression of Joaquin?
He only acknowledged me as Maron once. Like when I got there, it was like Mark Maron. And then it was like no talking to him. He wouldn't talk to anybody except for Todd, who I felt was just sort of like almost like a boxing trainer. You know, because he was dug into this thing. He was emaciated. He was in the Joker thing or what he decided to be in that reality. And Todd Phillips would, in between takes, it really looked like, you got this one, Rock. It was just keeping him isolated and wherever he needed to be. So it was no interaction.
Yeah, that sounds like Joaquin. I mean, I have an incredible relationship with him. We have a lot of trust in each other. But he would do insane things in the best sense.
Yeah.
Totally willing to break it open.
Yeah.
And take risks.
Well, that's great. Now, does anyone offer you like a big movie?
Yeah. They do.
Yeah.
But
like what? What have you turned down, James?
What have I turned down in my life? Well, here's one. It's weird. I'm uncomfortable talking about this because then some directors do it and they make a big success out of it. But
yeah,
the first time I turned down a movie called Devil's Own with Brad Pitt and Harrison Ford, which Alan Pakula wound up doing.
Oh.
Was that
like his last movie?
Yeah. And there was no script to it and I was just worried that I would screw it up, which I'm sure I would have. Pakula actually made something out of it, I thought.
Yeah. You like that guy?
Pakula?
Great, right?
I think he's made at least three tremendous movies.
President's Men, Parallax View.
And Clute, I think is a pretty brilliant movie.
Oh, man, that movie.
Yeah, it's a brilliant movie.
That Jane Fonda.
Incredible.
What?
Towards the end of that movie, Jesus. When she's dissembling, it's one of the greatest things ever.
And just like Donald Sutherland lumbering at the table.
Just amazing. Oof. And that the love story, the unlikely love story between Donald Sutherland and Jane Fonda, is an incredible film.
It really is.
Very moving, actually.
Yeah, I watched it recently. It's amazing.
Did it hold up for you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I find it a very moving film.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there you go. There's one. I love Roy Scheider as the pimp.
Yeah.
Roy Scheider is always sleazy.
It's like Roy Scheider in Marathon Man.
I love him.
He's always good. Yeah. Even in that Grisham movie, The Firm, that with the Coppola.
You're talking about Rainmaker.
The Rainmaker, yeah.
Where he plays the corporate executive.
Great. It's great.
He's like a lizard.
That's right, The Rainmaker, which is really like those weird later Coppola movies where, I don't know, he was like, a gun for hire, heavily
medicated.
Well,
as he says to pay back Chase Bank.
Yeah. But I mean, but it's a Coppola movie.
Of course.
That one is.
Of course it is.
I don't know if what was the one with James Caan?
The Rain People?
No, The Cemetery one.
Oh, you're talking about, Gardens of Stone, you mean.
Gardens of Stone.
Yeah.
How was that? I can't remember.
Well, I remember liking it, but I haven't seen it in 35 years, I've got to confess.
All right, so you were offered Devil's Own.
Yeah, you want to hear all these things, don't you?
Well, Goodwill
Hunting was one.
Oh, good call.
I mean, that was a huge hit. What do you mean?
I'm kidding.
Yeah,
You turned that down.
Yeah, of course. I'm an idiot. And I didn't, I'd never even heard of Matt Damon or Ben Affleck. I didn't know what the hell I was doing.
What year was that? Where were you working on?
Jesus, what was that? 1997 or something?
Oh, so right after Little Odessa. That was getting pitched.
Yeah, I was getting pitched stuff. And then recently there's been some stuff. But I don't know. It's like, I'm not sure. It's not because I'm like, pompous about it or I think I'm too good for the material. Quite the opposite. Usually I think it's because I won't do a good job doing what they want me to do with it. I like doing action sequences, but there's a panache and a quicksilver skill that they want.
Yeah.
And
but that, you, then
I don't
you
have
hire
that courage.
A guy.
What do you mean I hire a guy? What do you mean? Oh, you mean second unit guy?
Okay, second unit guy, a DP, and and then you just need the confidence to go like, let's get the cars going.
Okay, well, you know what? I don't know. I feel like cinema is different than that, but that's a good method to get the whole team around you, and then you just sit there and you have like a night. When's lunch? I don't know.
No, you say I've never done this before.
Right?
Have you?
Right. So you're
hired.
Yourself. I see. All right. Well, I'll have to learn from that. By the way, Batman's cool, right? Batman's like a real person, at least.
I don't know.
He doesn't fly around.
I haven't seen one in a while.
You haven't seen in a while? It's been a while since you've seen it. I like Tim Burton's second Batman. I think it's a really good movie. I think Michelle Pfeiffer's incredible in it.
She's always incredible.
Yes, she is. She's a great actress. But
I'm saying in that movie,
she's great.
What was that one? Was that the one with Danny DeVito?
Yeah.
That's the best Penguin.
That's what I'm talking
about. It's like an opera character. Well,
that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Right. So you can do something great. And he did it.
Are you pitching for, you want to do a comic book movie?
No, do I want to? No, I was saying if they offered me one, would I contemplate? And that's the one I probably would
Batman.
Do.
because he's a person.
He's a real person. He's, like, he's not like a talking fox or something or whatever.
No, I get it.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, or a superpower.
Yeah, he doesn't turn into a wrench. You know?
Yeah, who is that? Michael Keaton in the second one?
Yeah. It's Michael Keaton. He did the first two. Yeah, because he has the anguish. You feel him.
But the eyes, man.
Yeah,
he's great. He really kind of like physicalized it like nobody else.
By the way, he's sort of a genius.
Totally.
Yeah.
So you would do a big movie if you...
Yeah, I mean, why not?
I don't know.
It's a great tapestry to work in. I mean, my movie costs 5 cents.
Right.
Which is good, by the way, because you limit the risk and nobody gets mad at you when it makes $4.
So you're one of the incentives for your particular oeuvre, which are, you know, James Gray movies. Is that, you know, like can I make it cheaply and maybe, you know, I won't fuck it up?
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's absolutely true. Look, it's a very risky proposition making a film, you know, and you're always exposing yourself and you're going to look ridiculous.
But you feel confident now?
No. Confident?
Ever? No.
Well, I had huge confidence, yes, in 1993.
Yeah.
And then March 5th, 1994 happened.
Which is when
I went to see the assembly of Little Odessa, and it was the worst thing I ever saw in my life. I remember I was shooting that movie, and I was like, I am the greatest director in the English language.
Yes.
And I was like throwing crumbs on the water and back was sprouting beautiful lilies.
Uh-huh.
I had Vanessa Redgrave and I had Maximilian Schell and oh my God, how good can I get?
Yeah.
I am so good.
Yeah.
And then you realize that it's not the movie, that context is a bitch.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden the movie didn't work. And I thought, oh my God, what do I do? And I found myself having to save the film. I'm not kidding you. My confidence has never fully returned. 1994.
But I would have to assume that with Lost City of Z and Ad Astra, you know, you definitely, that required confidence, both of them.
I think it required a kind of insanity. I think...
That can double as confidence.
Yeah, I suppose
if
so.
If you hold on to it.
To your point, I remember thinking, I have a team behind me that can help.
Mm.
I think Z was more insane.
Mm-hmm.
Because the aspect of, like, I'm going to go down to the jungle and I'm going to do great. That's moron, insane.
It's a Friedkin move, like with his remake of what?
Oh, Sorcerer.
Yeah.
I love Sorcerer, by the way.
Best.
I think Sorcerer's an amazing movie.
Yeah, it's great. That's Scheider, too.
Yeah, that's Roy Scheider. Yeah. And casting, like, you know, real gangsters in the movie. It was madness back then. By the way, two major studios, $23 million in 1977.
Yeah.
That's like spending like $250 million today.
I think it was in you. I think you were like, I'm going to do it.
I'm going to do Sorcerer.
I'm going to go in there. I'm going to wear a bee suit and I'm going to deal with bugs.
But he had a hard time too. I mean, he was very competitive with Coppola, you know?
Yeah.
And that's why he went off to do Sorcerer. Coppola went off to do Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
Did the jungle thing.
There's a lot of swinging dicks around. A lot of dick fights back then.
Yes.
There was only four or five of them.
That's,
you know,
right.
What I mean? So I guess what I was getting at is that, you know, I see, like, we were talking about questions of fascism. We're talking about, you know, making movies. You make the films you want to make.
Yes, absolutely.
And there's a tremendous range and difference in all of them. You know who your heroes are. You know, it seems like, you know, tonally, and you know what you want to achieve and where you want to go, what you're exploring. It's taken you however long it's taken you, like 25 years to do an honest movie about your family.
Yes.
And your upbringing.
Yeah, but that was because I went to the jungle and I went to space and I just about had it.
No,
and
I get it. But you also said that there was no way to make that movie younger because you didn't have any hindsight.
No, that's all true too. But I think it was a lot of it was driven also, frankly, by seeing a country that was in deep trouble. I mean, there's
here.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of real, we have some real problems.
Dude, it's fucking, I've applied for permanent residency in Canada.
No, I understand that. I think that there are some things, you know, it's like, I know we say original sin, slavery, and it even goes back further. You know, Adolf Hitler thought we were an excellent role model. You know, he loved what we did with the indigenous peoples.
You're watching that Ken Burns?
It is absolutely fantastic.
I can only get through one, and I'm not ready to go on with it.
It is so disturbing. You know, by the way, if you were talking about Long Island earlier, do you know that the center of the Nazi Party in the United States was in Yaphank, Long Island in the 30s?
Yeah.
And you see photos of this stuff, and it's like these rallies that look like something right out of Berlin, 1934. It's disgusting.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had it in us.
Yeah, well,
we had eugenics in us.
Of course. And they, you know, and what became the Republican Party has been pushing back on, you know, New Deal socialism and Jews for a long time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There was a concerted effort. I guess Lewis Powell and the Supreme Court was
Powell Manifesto. That was a capitalism thing.
This whole idea to create
Chamber
this,
of Commerce.
Exactly. Yeah. And to try and undo that New Deal stuff.
And now they're doing it.
And they're going to do it.
Yeah, it's taken a long time. And, but they're also shifting the culture entirely away from what I would say, you know, New York Jewish intellectual influence and also diversity now.
Yep.
They're just trying to shift the culture away from it by legislating, you know, not teaching the history of Black Americans.
Absolute outrage.
And also, like, by belittling, you know, marginalized communities of all kinds to do this kind of, you know, to take over the culture and simplify it. Now, here's my point is that, you know, in telling the kind of stories you tell that are provocative and intimate, that I believe on some level that, you know, what's become mainstream entertainment with, now I'm talking like you, in terms of the accent, like with the Marvel Universe and whatnot, that it feeds a certain simplicity. Now, I'm not going to say that they're aiding fascism.
I completely agree with you 100%. If you give somebody a McDonald's hamburger to eat every day, and you say, here's another Big Mac, and here's another Big Mac, and here's and then I give you halibut sushi, your reaction is not, oh, the halibut sushi is great. Your reaction is, what the hell is this? The whole system has been primed to make sure that you accept only a superhero movie.
Yeah.
So the audience doesn't know what the fuck to make of another kind of movie. Like, for example, if you said to a college student today, dude, you're a sellout, would they even know what the hell you were trying to say? They'd say, well, that means there are no tickets left. I don't think they even know what a sellout means.
But the language around that has shifted, even with my peers, and I'm sure with your peers as well, is that, you know, the language of branding and the language of content. And then, you know, once you start saying things like authenticity, that it's all become the language of capitalism.
Totally.
So there is no sellout anymore if you can live with it.
Absolutely. Look, there is no question but that when you tell 58-year-olds, you know, it's okay to think Chewbacca is amazing. Now, I have nothing against Star Wars. It's fantastic, as we talked about. Yeah. I think Empire Strikes Back is a masterpiece. Yeah. But that's like for like 12-year-olds and 11-year-olds. 50-year-olds, we should be watching Hal Ashby. We shouldn't be watching, you know, Chewbacca, really.
But do you, okay, and I agree with you, but you're saying that we should be watching the legacy of Hal Ashby. I mean, we can't be
equivalent,
completely...
The equivalent of Hal Ashby.
Right, right. We can't be complete nostalgists.
No. I mean, what I mean is if they were an equivalent of Hal Ashby, but the system doesn't provide it anymore.
But not in a mainstream way.
Not in a mainstream way, right. Like the studios, they used to say, here is... I mean, many filmmakers have talked about this lately.
Sure.
But it's like, you had the B-pictures. You had Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers, by the way. You had that. You had that
for kids. Hundreds of B-pictures.
Yeah, they churned them out. You would go to Saturday morning, you'd see them both. But then... They also had, you know, William Wyler would make the letter or something, you know, and you had a large array of pictures. And then particularly in the 90s, you had all these independent movies that some of which, I have to say, were made by Harvey Weinstein,
and you
which
came
were
out
very
of that.
Different. Yeah, I did. And guess what? That is over. That is gone. The taste for it is gone. Now, can it come back? Maybe. But part of that is the capitalist power, the power that they have to limit the marketplace where only like a certain kind of movie gets made.
To see in movie theaters. It seems me that, like, you know, like there's a lot of shit made, dude. And a lot of it, like I couldn't be a director because I can't put, you know, 3 years of my fucking life into something and have it maybe stream somewhere.
That's very, very hard. That is, you're 100% right on that. It's because you have to give yourself to it. It's an anguish thing.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's like it takes years and hundreds of people, and then all of a sudden, boom, it's on content, right?
Yeah.
And it's somewhere on a website or an app or something.
Right. Streaming somewhere, yeah.
Streaming somewhere.
But the thing is like, I think that the content that we're, or the movies, the pictures that we're talking about are being made. It's just hard to find them. There's no press behind them. You know, they fall through the cracks.
100%.
And it's not, this is the shift I'm talking about, is that the culture used to be intellectual, artistic culture, you was driven by this stuff.
Yeah, I completely agree.
And that's gone. You know, all of that stuff, all of the conversations around that stuff, you know, even the people who used to be on talk shows, it's all changed.
You're so right. I have this weird obsession with YouTube where I'll go down a wormhole and I watch a bunch of it. Norman Mailer and Gore Vidal having like a debate on a nighttime, a very highly rated talk show, right?
Yeah.
And you're like, wait, what? The level of discourse is through the roof. James Baldwin and William F. Buckley having a debate at Oxford, and that's like on TV. What do you do? That's gone. The intellectual value.
But the weird thing is, sadly, it's like I believe that it's gone as a marker of culture, but I don't think it's gone. I just think that the priorities have shifted, which is even worse. Is that like, you know? No, it's all still here.
No, I agree with you on that. Of course, what I mean gone is we don't. It's not in the
same. We
don't
put a premium on it.
It's not the premium. It's not a kind of mainstream. It's been a bit marginalized.
Yeah. Well, mainstream, right? You know, what is mainstream? Is like I don't even understand. I don't know. I've never watched a Kardashian do anything.
No, I haven't.
You know, and occasionally, like, I see clickbait, you know, all of a sudden, like, look, I like Kanye's first few records, but now he's, like, trying to lead some sort of strange, you know, African-American anti-Semitic leadership conference.
I don't understand that. Do you?
Yes.
The anti-Semitism thing?
Yes.
What is that about? I don't get
it. It was unleashed in I think, in that community through churches, through Farrakhan, through, you know, feeling that... that somehow, you know, Jews were in control of things. It's a popular conspiracy in that culture. It has been for a long time. Something went bad after the 60s, and you know, it has something to do with the music business and slumlords. And I don't know how it all happened, but they've locked onto that particular the Jews run everything conspiracy.
It's the most upsetting thing ever. I'm what you're saying to me. I mean, Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney, right? Two out of the three were Jews.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we can hang on to that. But I think it's a mythology now to some people, and that whatever, you know, that there is no alliance anymore.
Yeah. No, I completely understand.
And then that shifted into, I think it shifted into the music business and out of the conversation about civil rights and that. And that...
But this is when I said to you, I said I was a lefty, but from the 60s, 70s.
No, I know, this is exactly what
I was talking about.
Right, but it's dated.
Yeah, it is. I am.
And, you know, there's an evolving progressiveness that, you know, we have to educate ourselves about around gender and race.
That's true.
That's become more sophisticated and more specific, and we're old.
That's true, but I will tell you this. I look at my children, who are very well educated in these matters, better than I am.
Sure.
At the same time, they seem to have no awareness of, understanding of, have not really been educated about the influence of capitalism and the market on a lot of these factors. In other words, there has been a kind of separation. And
you have to seek that out. How the fuck did you get educated on it? It's like, you know.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, but that you got, because someone goes, do you ever read that book?
Yeah.
And you're like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Is this true?
Yeah.
And you're like, holy shit, it is true. You know, you got to have those brain, you know, those mind-blowing books that lay that shit out.
Yep.
You know, and then you have to, you know, integrate that train of thought or that type of perception into the way you see the world.
It usually takes one person, a teacher usually, who with whom you really connect.
I'm trying to think of the book that kind of blew my mind open about the nefariousness of how capitalism works. Well, I wasn't a kid.
No, me neither. I was probably mid-20s.
Yeah.
It was. I can tell you, for me, it was this writer, Louis Althusser, who went crazy, actually, and I think stabbed his wife or strangled her. I can't remember which. But he wrote this thing about what he called the ISA, the ideological state apparatus.
Mm.
And that, I remember reading that and kind of going, huh, that's amazing. Now, I can't really talk about this because if I do, you know, it's like people think, you know, you're a pompous ass. You know, say Althusser at a dinner party and they want to bludgeon you to death.
Yeah.
But it definitely opened my mind into a new way of viewing capitalism, the power of that, the ideological power of that.
Yeah. Do you ever watch those Adam Curtis movies?
Oh, yeah, of course. Right. Fantastic. Why are you laughing? He's amazing. He's
no, because I love him.
Yeah,
no,
like
I'm
the OCD quality about
that.
Yeah, it's like I can't get enough of that shit.
Oh, it's crazy, man.
I know, but this is bad because, you know, this is not going to cheer you up in
what
life.
Do you mean?
You know, I need.
What are you looking to be cheered up?
A little bit.
Well, what do you do?
I don't really do anything. I listen to music. That cheers me up a little bit.
I listen to music sometimes. You know, I'll cook. You know, I fucking talk to my cats.
Cooking
is
good.
I'm in comedy clubs every fucking night of my life. I've been doing comedy all my life.
Does that work?
Sometimes.
You know, I used to see a particular comedian who's very famous, whose name I won't mention on this.
Yeah.
And he would be sitting at the Chateau Marmont every day, and I would go there to write, and he'd always be there, and he always looked much more miserable than anyone else in the room.
Uh-huh.
Looked the most miserable guy in the world, and then you would see his persona would be Mr. Happy Guy.
Sure. Yeah.
So I always think the comedians in private are like extremely anguished.
Is that not true? Well, I think that's a stereotype. But I mean, sure. I mean, sad, angry. But you can't generalize. You know, there's been an infusion into younger stand-ups. So the next generation of people, don't take it as seriously. Well, a lot of them come out of sketch now. They know how to work with other people. Those of us who got into it because we were complete social morons and, you know, completely uncomfortable and, you know. But it's a different generation, you know.
Yeah, but I
go watch some Rodney Dangerfield. They'll help you out.
Oh yeah, he seems like he would have been a very cheerful fellow in life.
Miserable.
Oh my God, yes. You can see it.
But I feel like it's like, you know, the more I sort of like, as Keith Richards continues living and I my love for him grows and I go back to it. Like, you know, Rodney is one of these unsung heroes. A really truly unique guy.
Well, he was one of the greats.
Yeah, but I don't know that he gets the props he gets. You know,
really?
He gets it from certain people, but I think in the big picture, he actually does not get the respect he deserves.
Rodney, I feel like you mentioned
you,
his
no
name.
Respect, no respect at all.
He's like
you
a god.
Sure.
Of course.
Yeah.
But maybe it's because I'm old.
And I just, sometimes you watch him on Carson when he's bombing. You got the right mic on, right?
Yeah, I know. He's brilliant. It's brilliant, of course. But I also love the sort of Borscht Belt thing.
Sure.
I love those guys.
Of course we do. That's how I got into it. You know, Buddy Hackett, still like Buddy Jackie Vernon I would watch. Yeah,
but
you know?
By the way, Buddy Hackett, that's like, I was watching The Music Man with my kids, and Buddy Hackett is like actually a song and dance man in that.
Yeah, with his little weird,
that's a little weird.
Goofy mush mouth face.
Shapoopy. Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. The Love Bug, he's in The Love Bug.
Yes. Well, he is Buddy Hackett after all.
Yeah, but I used to think he was funny. Anyway, yeah, Rickles and all those guys. We grew up with that shit.
Rickles,
know?
Whom I met, by the way, I'm happy to say, immediately took a liking to me, which meant he was, of course, instantly insulting over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And my wife thought that was the greatest thing she'd ever heard.
Of course. Why wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I got a great book. Have you seen that book of photographs of the hotels now?
Oh, in the Catskills, you mean?
Yeah.
It's the most haunting things. There were like Grossingers and the Concord. Oh, my
you've
God.
You've seen that book?
Yeah, they're like modern ruins.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's amazing.
It's like
I want to go see it.
No one's going to, there's still lounge chairs and shit.
Isn't that amazing?
There's a bowling ball, you know? Like,
I want to go there.
I don't know if it's still like that. You can go there. Maybe that'll bring you joy.
Yeah, well, I like modern ruins.
Yeah. Good talking to you, man.
Great talking to you.
Thanks for doing it. I hope your wife enjoys it.
I'm sure she will.
Armageddon Time is now playing in theaters and available to rent on video on demand. That was James Gray. Enjoy that guy. We've been texting. We've been texting each other pictures of food we cook. So, okay, hang out a minute, you guys. Just hang out.
Wann hast du zuletzt eine Stelle besetzt und gedacht, das war einfach? Wahrscheinlich lange her. Recruiting kann echt kompliziert sein. Es geht aber auch anders. Die Recruiting-Plattform Instafo liefert dir dank AI Matchmaking nur passende Bewerbungen in deine Pipeline und per Chat kannst du direkt mit ihnen kommunizieren. Instafo erreicht über Podcasts, Reddit, YouTube und Co. Talente, die sonst schwer zu finden sind. Funktioniert für Enterprises wie RTL und GLS, aber auch für Scale-Ups wie DoInstruct und Finanzguru. Du zahlst nur bei Erfolg und sparst über instafo.com/podcast 500 € bei deiner ersten Einstellung.
Okay, folks, my recommendation from our archives today is episode 581 with Mick Foley. Mick Foley is a Hall of Fame professional wrestler, as well as an author and actor. And he's also someone I got to know while doing my old radio show, Morning Sedition.
Well, I it's great to see you. I mean, despite whatever I may not know about wrestling, we always seem to have a fairly rich conversation.
We do. I think because when I met you, it was on the Air America show.
Yeah, yeah.
And at that time, I knew quite a bit. And
didn't we do a bit?
We did a lot of bits.
Didn't we do that one where we had Brendan play the conservative,
yeah.
Right? And he won this. He was going to fight, wrestle me or something, and then we brought you in, and we did that whole script on the air, and then we cut the mics. For years, people thought it was real.
Really?
We would get this mail sort of like, hey, look, you know, they have a right to talk too. I don't agree with them, but I think what you did to that guy.
That's right. And I remember just how talented the writers were on that show.
Oh, yeah, it was a blast,
dude. When I came in and co-hosted for a week with you, I was like, 5 a.m. and here's the production meeting. These guys are just great.
You can listen to that episode for free on all podcast platforms. It's episode 581 with Mick Foley. And you'll want to check it out if you have a full Marin subscription, because next week we're going to post some bonus content that involved Mick with a wrestling angle on the radio. That was some back in the day shit there. Yeah. We did a wrestling piece. Radio wrestling piece. Sold out shows tomorrow in Asheville, North Carolina. Still some seats left for my shows on Saturday at the James K. Polk Center in Nashville, Tennessee. And very few seats left for my HBO special taping at Town Hall in New York City on Thursday, December 8th. Maybe a couple. Guitar time.
Boomer lives, Monkey, La Fonda, Cat Angels everywhere, yeah, 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 yeah.